Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we are talking about regulations. The California Public Utilities Commission regulates the state's basic infrastructure, including electric, natural gas, telecommunications, water, railroad, rail transit, and transportation companies. It's a very powerful state agency. The PUC has long been criticized for favoring utility companies over consumers, and more recently for cozying up to big tech companies like Uber and Lyft, which results in more relaxed regulation. So on today's Your Call, we are going to talk about how the PUC actually operates and what it really takes to regulate powerful corporations. Today, we're joined by Loretta Lynch, former president of the California Public Utilities Commission. Loretta Lynch is a lawyer and community-based consultant working with groups and organizations that oppose pipeline projects and fossil fuel power plants. And Loretta Lynch joins us in studio. Hi, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Rose.
I've been wanting to have you on for a while just to learn more about how regulation works, because whenever we do shows about Uber and Lyft, we always invite on the California PUC and they never come on the show. So we'll talk about that in a minute. But first I want, and they're invited to come on anytime. Let's talk a little bit about the history of the California Public Utilities Commission. How was it created and why was it created?
So the PUC was a reform measure back at the turn of the 20th century. In 1911, Hiram Johnson, the governor, put an initiative on the ballot to create a commission that would be separate from the legislature and separate from the governor to regulate the key and critical must-haves of the day: railroads, water, electricity, and gas, as well as this new telephone system. So it's a constitutional commission that the people voted in to break the hold that the Union Pacific Railroad had on the legislature and the governor. And so it was seen as a reform measure. The problem is money talks. And so all those powerful financial interests figured out that they could actually it was advantageous to them to co-opt three of the five commissioners rather than a majority of the legislature.
How are the commissioners appointed?
The commissioners are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the state senate, and they serve for six-year terms.
And I understand that with our new governor, Gavin Newsom, really now is the time to make your voice heard if you'd like to have a say on who these commissioners are.
Well,
and governor, he's appointed too, right?
Yes. So he's appointed Commissioner Sharoma, Genevieve Sharoma, who actually was confirmed in July before the legislature left. So she's on for 6 years. And he's also newly appointed the president, Maribel Basher, and she will be up for confirmation in front of the state senate. So absolutely, people should make their voices heard with their state senators and draw a line in the sand. The president of the PUC should protect the people and not Wall Street and the utilities. And the Senate should not confirm until there are demonstrated votes that show that the president of the PUC has voted to protect the people and not Wall Street and the utilities.
What do you think of Gavin Newsom's choices?
I think it's too soon to tell. The problem is we still have a majority of the commission that was appointed by the last governor who was quite cozy with the utilities. And the problem there is the PUC majority is allowing the utilities to run amok around the California economy. And we have to stop that.
Well, talk about just how powerful this agency is, because they regulate so much. I mean, I listed the industries, but these are massive and so powerful: electric, natural gas, telecommunications, water, transportation companies like Uber and Lyft, railroad. This is one agency that does all of this.
So some experts have estimated that the PUC's decisions affect up to 20% of the California's economy. But I would argue it affects everybody, because they set how much we have to pay for electricity. They set how much we have to pay for natural gas. And they set for the 20% of Californians who get their water from private water companies and not public water companies, they set the rates. So every month, every business and every California family is affected by the decisions of the California Public Utilities Commission.
They set the rates.
They set the rates. So essentially, they get to pick your pocket if they are in the pocket of the utilities.
And we'll definitely talk about the utilities on today's show, but a few more general questions. So the governor of California appoints the members of the California Public Utilities Commission, five commissioners. The state Senate has to approve them. Who oversees the commission?
Well, technically, the legislature has what's called plenary authority over the commission, and they could hold oversight hearings, and they also have authority over the commission's budget. But in reality, there's so much the legislature is doing, and frankly, there's so much, and it's so highly detailed what the PUC is doing, that that kind of oversight often slips to the bottom of the priority list. And so really, what's happened in the last 15 years is that the Public Utilities Commission of the state of California has gone rogue. They do whatever they want, whenever they want, with whomever they want, and we pay.
I should say that Loretta Lynch is a very big critic of corporate Democrats, and she really does speak her mind about these issues. What were you doing before you were appointed commissioner of the California PUC?
I was a partner at a litigation law firm in San Francisco, Kecker and Van Nest, and I did quite a bit of white-collar criminal defense work, which actually stood me in really good stead when Enron came along, because I issued 127 subpoenas to the players in our electricity market, and they all lawyered up, which is what I would have told my clients to do if they were guilty.
Wow. You were heavily involved in that, right? I was thinking about the blackouts. I remember when I think it was Gray Davis, right, governor at the time, said you got to turn the lights off in the buildings. I mean, it was amazing to be in the East Bay and see San Francisco completely dark.
Right. So in 1996, before Gray Davis was governor, Pete Wilson was governor, he rammed through this huge energy deregulation bill with a lot of false promises, with a lot of greenwashing from the national environmental groups, all saying we're going to get better, cleaner, cheaper power if we open our markets to essentially the barbarians who were at the gates clawing in, because they understood if we opened our markets, they could make money. And make money they did. So by the time I came onto the PUC in 2000, we already had some problems in our markets. But all the committed deregulationists were saying, oh, just keep buying power and you'll buy your way out of it. You can't buy your way out of market manipulation. So Enron was the first and the best marauder who jacked us up for billions of dollars in excess profits, meaning California's economy. But they weren't the only ones. And the problem here is Wall Street saw what Enron did and said, hey, we can do that better. So now who's in our electricity markets? Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, all the other Wall Street firms, plus a ton of hedge funds making money, arbitraging us every day. There was already hints of increased manipulation in the California market today. And the PUC's response is, oh, we'll just buy more and we'll have so much excess power that they won't be able to corner the market. That never works. We saw it in 2000. But frankly, the other problem here was that energy deregulation bill in 1996 was passed within a month. And it was a go-go, must-go kind of bill. And everybody came on board, including the consumer groups, because they all got something for their support. Fast forward to 2019. The governor just proposed and the legislature just passed in a week a comprehensive wildfire bill that not only protects future victims, which I'm all for, but also makes extraordinary changes to the ability of the Public Utilities Commission to actually oversee the utilities. I'm the first to say that the current commission is a lapdog, not a watchdog. Hmm. But at least we had statutes on the books that enabled the PUC to be a watchdog. Now some of those statutes have been repealed. What you don't want is a statutory lapdog. You want a statutory watchdog and also a watchdog in reality.
So you went from the Enron case to becoming the commissioner of the California Public Utilities Commission. I mean, just regulating the utilities on their own is a big job. Can you just talk about what the process is like? Do you have meetings on a regular basis to talk about regulating utilities? Do you meet with utilities executives and politicians and consumer groups? Just can you explain how that works?
Sure. There are five commissioners. They each have a small personal staff. And then there are over 1,000 people who are civil servants who work at the Public Utilities Commission. And I would say a majority of those folks really care about the public interest. The problem is the political appointments at the head of the commission steer the ship. And so it's much like a ship. If the captain says go, then those public servants have to go. Oops. And I think I've just gotten kicked off the thing.
Oh, you're okay. You're still in the air.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I couldn't hear myself. So the problem is that the PUC is an administrative agency, and they're supposed to act like an administrative agency. Documents, public documents, are supposed to be filed at the PUC for the commissioners and all other parties to consider and respond to. Then there are supposed to be evidentiary hearings before the PUC ever imposes a charge on utility customers. And the process is supposed to play out in public, on the record, and it's supposed to be fact-based. The problem is, after I left the commission, my successor, Mike Peavy, decided it was going to be his way or the highway. So he started cutting back on all the formal processes. He started having roundtables where people would just sit around the table and say what they thought, rather than evidentiary hearings where there would be discovery and testimony and witnesses under oath. So if you don't have a witness under oath on a fact-based administrative process, then the PUC can decide whatever it wants. And most importantly, the utilities can say whatever they want, and they don't have to stick to the facts. So what happened was, over the last 15 years, the PUC cut corners, put a lot of stuff behind closed doors, changed its rules so that a lot of the decisions they make are not public until they make them, and sometimes not even then. So, for instance, today, the PUC will approve a contract for power between the utility and a plant owner, and you and I and the legislature cannot know what its terms are. Why? Because the PUC decreed it that way. No other state does that, only California. So the PUC has, that's why what I mean when I say the PUC has gone rogue. They are no longer an administrative agency that plays by the rules and is more than happy to have their decision-making process open to the public. Instead, it's behind closed doors where they make the secret deals.
How are they allowed to do that?
The legislature hasn't stopped them, although I will say the legislature did try. Senator Jerry Hill has really been a champion in trying to make the PUC get back to fact-based public decision-making. And he carried numerous bills over the last 6 years to rein in the PUC. Most of those were vetoed by Governor Brown, or they were watered down. So I really hope that the legislature gets back to real oversight of the PUC and not just the slash and burn, let's take it away from the PUC and put it into some other new entity that doesn't know what it's doing.
Today, we're speaking with Loretta Lynch, former president of the California Public Utilities Commission. This is a very powerful commission that is supposed to regulate the state's basic infrastructure, transportation companies like Uber and Lyft, which we will talk about, utility companies like PG&E. Loretta is a lawyer, and she's now a community-based consultant working with groups and organizations that oppose pipeline projects and fossil fuel power plants. And if you have any questions about regulation and how the PUC operates, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. If you have any questions about how the governor chooses these commissioners and the transparency, we'd love to hear from you. So since you brought up the bill, AB, can you remind me? AB
1054.
Thank you. Let's talk about what this did. You said that you're very happy that this will help future victims of wildfires, but it does not help current victims of wildfires. Is that right?
That's correct. The Wildfire Victims Fund that was created by AB 1054 is for future wildfires, not past wildfires.
And can you give us some background on that? Because we've done so many shows about the horrific wildfires, and people in Paradise, many of them are still homeless. They're still trying to put their lives together.
Well, frankly, that's one of the reasons I opposed AB 1054, because it didn't directly help current victims of wildfires. The theory is that if you restore the utilities to financial viability by limiting their future wildfire liability, then they'll do the right thing and take care of current victims. And there's some talk about how there's a side deal in the bankruptcy court that will fund current victims. The problem is the side deal depends upon the same kinds of hedge funds that have had a scorched earth policy in the bankruptcy court to date. So the Wall Street Journal noted right after the bill was passed that there's a particular hedge fund that stood to gain from this from the passage of this bill. Basically, it's a fight between the bondholders of PG&E and the shareholders of PG&E, who's going to be the biggest bandit in terms of taking money out of PG&E. And so the theory is that in the bankruptcy process, either the bondholders or the shareholders will take care of the current victims. But that's not set in stone, and it certainly hasn't been approved by the bankruptcy judge. So what we've done is we've created a fund for future victims. I'm all for that, although I do think it should have been funded on a one-to-one basis. Every dollar that the ratepayers put in, the shareholders put in a dollar. But instead, the shareholders' contribution was capped at $10.5 billion, whereas the ratepayers' contribution is not capped. It's unlimited. So if the utilities don't do the right thing in the future, and if the PUC doesn't become a watchdog and not a lapdog and make them actually fix their systems, then we've certainly provided a disincentive for the utilities to do the right thing because we capped their liability before they did the right thing. Right. And we haven't required them to do the right thing. All they have to do is file a safety plan at the commission, and eventually it won't be at the commission, it will be at a different agency, and then that plan has to be approved. Well, the problem is the PUC has a terrible track record in approving what's called the wildfire mitigation plans. They just approved the first one on an outline. It was like being assigned a term paper about all the ways you were going to prevent wildfires, and you gave the teacher an outline, and the teacher gave you an A. So on an outline, the PUC said, sure, that's all you have to do, and then fill in the details later through a process called advice letters. Well, that's a problem if what you're trying to do is get the utilities to fix the system right now, to prevent wildfires right now. So we've capped utility liability. We've made unlimited for the future wildfire victims ratepayer liability. And then we're relying on essentially I would call them the new barbarians at the gate, Paul Singer and Elliott Capital Management and his crew, to be good to their word that was given behind closed doors. We don't even know what the details of the deal are in bankruptcy court. And then we're relying further on the court to accept that. Well, the shareholder groups that are competing with Paul Singer and his group are saying, hey, wait a minute, we can do it cheaper. Do it this way. So we now have a new law that relies on a side deal that isn't cooked and certainly hasn't been approved to take care of current wildfire victims. To me, that's pretty iffy, and I don't think one should make good policy on an iffy side deal that relies on a whole bunch of players that you can't control.
And what does that mean, to take care of wildfire victims? What do we...
It means to pay their claims. It means to make them whole.
Okay.
So it wasn't their fault.
Right. And if someone loses their house and does not have house insurance, and basically, let's say they're 65.
That's right.
Right? And they're retired. And they get a $1,000 Social Security check a month. Where do you live in the state of California?
Exactly. And that's why I thought the focus should be about current victims, taking care of them first, then holding the utility's feet to the fire to prove that they would have the burden of proof that their plans actually mitigate and prevent wildfires. Instead, this bill shifts the burden of proof. And that is a monumental, fundamental change. Even today at the PUC, the utilities bear the burden of proof to prove that their costs are reasonable. This bill for all wildfire costs reverses that, and we presume the utilities' costs are reasonable, and other parties have to prove that they aren't. So that provides a disincentive for the utilities, one, to keep their costs down and be efficient, but also, two, to do what they say they're going to do, because it's going to be a lot harder for the PUC to look back in future years and check to see if the utilities did what they said they were going to do.
Right. So can you elaborate on that? Because in our shows about wildfires, we've talked about, because they've waited so long to deal with this crisis of the wires, for example, just to even just talk simply about that, It's now going to be very, very expensive. If you put the wires underground, it's very, very expensive. So what does this legislation say utility companies need to do to prevent fires in the future?
Get a safety certification from the PUC.
What does that mean?
That means whatever the PUC says it means. And the PUC just gave them a safety certification based on an outline, that the details of which are going to be filled in later. Yeah. So when you rely on wildfire prevention, when you rely on the lapdog to ensure wildfire prevention, we should all be worried.
Can you remind us, there have been so many stories about criminal negligence and what PG&E did or did not do to cause and prevent the fires. Can you remind us, what do we now know at this point?
Well, we know that PG&E is a convicted felon because of its criminal negligence in not maintaining its gas pipeline system sufficiently to prevent the deaths that occurred in San Bruno and the destruction, but the deaths. So as a condition of their criminal probation, the judge said, hey, we're going to look at what you're doing on the electrical side of your company as well. Of course, PG&E fought that, but they're a convicted felon, and the judge, as a condition of probation, can assign whatever probation conditions he wants. Judge William Alsup of the Northern District of our federal district court system here in San Francisco, he is phenomenal. He is the Mr. Smith goes to Washington of this scenario, because he has set a very simple standard for PG&E, which is he doesn't want PG&E to kill another Californian. And sadly, that's a low bar, and PG&E hasn't been able to meet that bar since San Bruno. So he is now increasingly taking oversight control over the electrical system. So for instance, the week that the AB 1054 passed the legislature, the Wall Street Journal issued a special investigation showing that PG&E knew for years that its lines could spark wildfires, yet it didn't fix them. At the same time, they spent over $5 billion in dividends to their shareholders. They gave over $5 billion in dividends to the shareholders and countless hundreds of millions in political contributions. So good for Judge Alsup. Immediately the next day, he ordered PG&E to file specifically explaining why, and I quote, the offender, meaning PG&E, shall set forth the full amount of campaign contributions and to whom such contributions were made since January of 2017. So for the last 2 years, because the Wall Street Journal said they've known for years, but they've certainly known since an internal corporate memo of January 2017. And, the judge goes on, shall explain why those campaign contributions were more important than replacing or repairing the aging transmission lines. And PG&E is supposed to file this document tomorrow at noon. So it's high noon on July 31st for PG&E when they go into Judge Alsup's court and explain how they could be spending money on politicians and dividends instead of safety. This should be safety first at the most reasonable expense for the ratepayer. It should not be safety last as we shovel money out the door to shareholders and bondholders.
And the LA Times reported in 2016, PG&E is found guilty of obstructing investigators after the deadly 2010 fire. I also just wanted to ask you before we go to break, the state of California could have indicted individuals for the San Bruno fires, but did not. And Kamala Harris was attorney general at that time?
Yes.
Can you talk about her role in all of this?
Well, there were both state crimes and federal crimes that PG&E committed in its criminal negligence in not maintaining its gas pipeline systems that caused death and destruction in San Bruno. And there were both state and federal investigations. The feds indicted the company. The state did not. And the state did not indict the individuals. So basically, not one PG&E executive or decision maker went to jail. They weren't even charged. The company was charged. And thankfully, the company's on probation, which is the only way that Judge Alsup can hold them accountable. And my concern is the entity that should be holding them accountable, the way that Judge Alsup is holding them accountable, is the PUC. It's not doing its job. We have to ask why and how we can fix that.
And what does it mean to hold a company accountable? Because I'm just reading now from KGO, more than 6 years after a PG&E pipeline explosion killed 8 people and injured dozens more, a San Francisco judge handed down a sentence that will put PG&E's crimes in the spotlight. What does it mean to go after a company but not the corporate executives?
Well, the company had to pay money.
Right.
And then the company is now the biggest consequence of being a convicted criminal felon for PG&E is that they have probation. They're on probation, just like anybody else who commits a crime. And so the company itself has to go in and report to the judge. And thankfully for California, this judge is serious about holding PG&E, the corporation, accountable.
Could the AG's office have done anything else when
Absolutely.
Kamala Harris was in that position?
Sure. The AG could have indicted PG&E as well, and the AG could have indicted the people who were responsible for the criminal negligence.
Do we know why Harris's office didn't do that?
I don't know. You'd have to ask the AG.
Today we are speaking with Loretta Lynch, former president of the California Public Utilities Commission. This is a powerful state agency that is supposed to regulate so many industries, electric, telecommunications, water, transportation. And Loretta is a lawyer and community-based consultant who is now working with organizations that oppose pipeline projects and fossil fuel power plants. And today we are talking about how this agency works, and we're talking about regulation overall. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about why so many horses are dying. 30 horses have died at the Santa Ana Racetrack in Southern California since last December. Horse racing is now a multi-billion dollar industry. So can this industry be reformed, or should it be banned? That is tomorrow. And then Thursday, as school is about to start in a couple of weeks, we will get an update on teacher strikes across the country. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can send us an email, yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are talking about what it means to regulate corporations and what happens when politicians and government officials become too cozy with the corporations they're supposed to regulate. We're joined by Loretta Lynch, former president of the California Public Utilities Commission. They are a powerful state agency that is supposed to regulate a number of industries, including telecom, electric, and transportation companies. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. And we have a number of callers on the line. Let's go to Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Yes, hello.
Hi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. After California passed legislative term limits, the legislature became much more indebted to lobbyists with respect to the California Public Utilities Commission and the complex issues there. So I'd like you to discuss how that affects the agency, as well as in the late 90s, the enactment of the so-called strong president statute that basically made the governor choose the appoint the president of the commission. And as a result, the executive branch of the commission is staffed with a lot of non-civil servants that are appointed by the governor or are in close contact with the governor's office, compared with the former history of the commission. And then finally, that even when you switch out the commissioners, the management, especially the top management, the second tier management that was appointed by former commissioners, stays in place. So that all of the managers that were selected by PV, for example, are not only there, but many of them were even promoted. And I would like you to discuss how that affects the agency and the regulatory ability of the agency. Thank you.
Your questions are well taken. Basically, it hobbles the agency even more because the folks who want to do the job and follow the law are sat on by senior management who are beholden to the political appointees who have put them in those places. Absolutely. As to the lobbying issue, what I saw this last year was Wall Street understood how much money was on the table with this PG&E bankruptcy and the wildfire victims fund. And so they formed lobbying entities. It'll be very interesting to see at the end of the year when they file all their reports just how much money Wall Street spent and the hedge funds spent and the vulture creditors spent to influence both the governor's office and the legislature on this bill and bills like it to essentially make sure that they were going to profit rather than make sure that we protected the ratepayers.
You also pointed out that when PG&E's share price dropped down to $7, a number of creditors bought a lot of shares. And I'm just looking right now, it's at $18.16. So it went up $11.
Right. So the vulture creditors made hundreds of millions of dollars based on their bet that California would bail out PG&E. We did it before. I voted against that bankruptcy bailout in 2003. On a 3-2 vote, California gave PG&E everything they wanted, the sun and the moon and the stars, without requiring anything from them in return. So PG&E understands the playbook. If it worked once, it might work twice.
Thank you for calling in, Leslie. Let's go next to Steve in Mountain View. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. You mentioned Senator Jerry Hill as being a champion in this regard, but he is termed out, and I wanted to know if there was any other, if there were any other legislators that are champions for your cause. And then I also wanted to know if the organization Turn, to which I belong, is helping you in this.
It is very disappointing for me to criticize the good folks at Turn. They try, and they try hard. But they supported AB 1054, unclear why. They supported energy deregulation, unclear why. They opposed the first bankruptcy bailout until Mike Peavy threatened their compensation at the PUC because they get money for participating as a public participant at the PUC. And then they switched. It was a switch in time that saved them $1 million but cost the ratepayers. And they supported a backroom deal on the San Onofre nuclear power plant that Peavy wanted. So while in general they do good work, in this instance, very sadly, they have fallen down. But I would like to call out the courageous legislators who voted against this bill or did not vote for it. And many of those are here in San Francisco and the Bay Area, led by, I would say, Senator Scott Wiener and our assembly people, David Chu and Phil Ting. They voted no because there's a poison pill that was added at the last minute to this bill, added on July 5th, the Friday of the long holiday weekend, then voted on the next Monday. That would make it a lot harder to municipalize, to take over the utilities by a government. Why was that poison pill added? We don't know, because really there were kind of shotgun hearings that where that was not explored. And so there were a couple dozen courageous legislators who took a stand and said, hey, this is going too fast, it's too big, we need to slow this down. Sadly, the train ran them over, and the bill is now law.
What other organizations opposed AB 1054?
It was a small handful of organizations, and the problem there was it went so fast. The bill was just proposed on June 27th, the week before the 4th of July holiday. Then it was substantially amended on July 5th, and then it was voted out of the Senate on July 8th. So it went so fast, and it was a holiday, that the groups barely had an ability to read the bill, much less show up to oppose it.
What is the current status of San Francisco potentially buying out PG&E and switching over to public power?
Well, sadly, AB 1054 really throws a monkey wrench into that process because it requires newly for any transfer of any utility asset, a wrench, a socket, or a pole, to first go to the PUC for approval before the local government can make that transfer. So in general, if you're talking about a local government, a public entity, the public entity does not have to go to the PUC. They can go to court or they can make their own agreement with a utility to take over utility assets. Now, under this new law, they have to go to the PUC. And let's just say the PUC is cozily co-opted by the utilities that it purports to regulate.
What about cities that are already offering this service? How does it affect them?
Well, that's going to be an interesting question. The CCEs, the Community Choice Energy Groups.
Right.
So at this point, they just procure the power. They just buy the power. They don't deliver the power.
Right. It's still delivered
by
PG&E.
Or Edison or SDG&E or your local utility.
Right.
So So for them, it's not going to be as big of a deal unless they would like to buy the means by which we distribute the power. And then they would have to go to the PUC as well. And the PUC, I have to say, has demonstrated outright hostility to the entire CCE movement.
You know, at the end of the day, this is really about being a public servant and fighting for the people. And you're a big critic of corporate Democrats. When we talk about California, we always note that the Dems right now have a supermajority in Sacramento. They can pretty much do whatever they want without a Republican vote. But there are a lot of corporate Dems in Sacramento. Who is really, in your view, how many people are really fighting for the public interest and are not really taking much money or any money from corporations in Sacramento?
You know, there are a lot of champions, and a lot of people tried to make this bill better. They were rebuffed, but they tried, and you got to tip your hat to them. I would say that Assemblymember Mark Stone from Santa Cruz is a true progressive champion, as is Senator Hannah Beth Jackson from Santa Barbara. There are many. Assemblymember Levine, he voted against this bill because he knows that municipalization is the way to go. Ultimately, this is what we're facing in California. We are at a historic moment in time where new technologies and old, moribund, corrupt utilities are clashing, but they're providing us a great opportunity. We could go in California 100% renewable, I believe, within the next 10 years, and we could do it for a reasonable price. But our policymakers have to be fully on board with that. You can't buy both fossil and renewable. There's not enough money in your utility bill to buy both. You have to make the choice. So we can either make the choice now, do it smart, and essentially create an energy democracy in California where local governments or regional governments own the system, push the profit out of the system, and use that profit to maintain the system that's renewable, reliable, and safe. Or we can continue to play footsie with the big fossil guys and the Berkshire Hathaways and the Wall Street moguls and all the people who are ripping us off right now in our electricity markets and poised to rip us off in this PG&E bankruptcy. And then we'll go slow, we'll be behind, it'll be expensive, and it'll be painful.
We did a lot of shows about Jerry Brown, former Governor Jerry Brown, and a number of environmental groups were constantly criticizing him, protesting when he gave talks about his relationship with oil and gas. What do you expect from Gavin Newsom?
I expect better. I hope that our governor is not as tied to the hip with the utilities as our prior governor was, because our Brown was not green, and it certainly not enough green for California. I mean, we have this historical choice. If we spend billions of dollars on dividends and hedge funds and the fourth generation of smart meters that we've already spent billions of dollars giving them goodies, giving the utilities profits on, if we up the utilities profits, which is currently in front of the PUC, the California utilities have some of the highest profit levels of any utility in the nation. And what did the utilities do at the end of April? They came in and asked for more. So right now, PG&E's about 11.67% profit. That means 11.67 cents of every dollar goes into their pocket that we pay. They just asked for a 16% profit. Why? Because of wildfire risk and regulatory uncertainty. Well, who created that wildfire risk and regulatory uncertainty? They did. So they're saying, let us profit more from our terrible actions. And all eyes should be on the PUC to shut that outrageous request down.
What role does do the Democrats in Sacramento have when it comes to these higher electricity bills?
Well, they could hold oversight hearings on the PUC. They could say, just say no. They could pass a law that says, no, the utilities do not get to increase their profit. And in fact, the utilities should be at the median profit for utilities across the United States, not some of the highest. They could pass laws that would really rein in the costs if they chose to.
Today we're speaking with Loretta Lynch, former president of the California Public Utilities Commission, a very powerful state agency that is in charge of regulating many industries in the state, including electric, telecommunications, and transportation companies. We're going to take a few more calls about PG&E, and then we will move on and talk about why the state failed to regulate Uber and Lyft. Let's hear from Magic in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I'm just so grateful to Loretta for what she's doing. Yesterday I was at the Land Use and Transportation Committee meeting, and San Francisco is moving forward to take over the infrastructure of PG&E. So I was wondering, because the RACER Act, the federal act, declared that we have to become a public utility, and the PUC has allowed PG&E to use our power, in fact, stealing it from Hetch Hetchy, that wouldn't that law override the PUC's right to rule? And how best can we take over? Because all the Board of Supervisors is forward, going forward in taking over PG&E in San Francisco.
You bring up a really important point. There is a federal law that is specific to San Francisco because we own Hetch Hetchy, the county of San Francisco does. And so how San Francisco in particular is situated vis-a-vis the state and PG&E is different from how every other city and county is situated. And I agree with you. Let's go find out what the limits of the RACER Act are. Let's go use every single legal tool and political tool in our toolbox to get out from under this criminal, felonious corporation that has shown no real commitment to safety, reliability, or reasonable prices.
Thank you for calling in. Let's hear next from Jane in Oakland. Hi, Jane. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Let me turn off my radio.
Okay, thanks.
Mike, thank you very much for this discussion. It's wonderful to hear somebody so impassioned make the cases so clear. I am a PG&E customer, as is everybody, and from time to time I get a notice in my bill that there's going to be a hearing, usually about a rate hike, and I assume that because the system is so corrupt, it's pointless to go to those hearings. But I wanted to ask Loretta Lynch what she thinks is the impact of the public showing up at hearings like that.
There's some impact for a public participation hearing. By the way, they have to hold them, otherwise they wouldn't. But in general, those rate increases are decided primarily behind closed doors. There's an administrative process that's supposed to be fact-based, but more and more, there aren't evidentiary hearings. There's limited discovery, there's limited testimony, and they just go along to get along. More impactful would be you showing up at your legislator's door and communicating to the governor's office that you want fact-based evidentiary hearings with discovery and witnesses, and the PUC should act like a fact-based administrative agency and not like a Trump-based puppet.
Well, thank you for calling in, Jane. Let's now switch gears and talk about Uber and Lyft. I wish we had a little bit more time, but we'll have to have you back. We've done a lot of shows about Uber and Lyft drivers really struggling to make ends meet. We've heard so many stories about people sleeping in their cars. They're very tired when they're driving. We now know, according to many reports, here's one from KTVU, 45,000 Uber and Lyft drivers are in San Francisco on any given day. Another article from the Chronicle, Uber and Lyft account for 2/3 of traffic increases in San Francisco over 6 years. We all see it. We all feel it. Before we talk about Uber and Lyft's massive wealth, can you give us a little bit of a backstory? The California PUC is the agency that is in charge of regulating Uber and Lyft. And I notice whenever I ask local politicians, like when we had the mayoral race in San Francisco, some of the candidates said, well, that's not up to us. It's up to the PUC, so they can kind of wash their hands of even addressing the crisis. What happened when Uber and Lyft decided to come to California? Why were there not stronger regulations?
Because I hired a former PUC commissioner to lobby the people she helped get on that board in private. In fact, the Fair Political Practices Commission fined her over $30,000 for doing that lobbying and not registering to tell people she was lobbying her former colleagues and people she helped get that job. So she worked for Lyft. Lyft paid her to make sure that the regulations were as light and unintrusive as possible. The PUC largely adopted what Lyft asked for, and she got paid, and the ratepayers paid, or basically the people who use Uber and Lyft and the Lyft drivers paid, got paid. She did get fined for that violation, but it's just a window into that world of backroom deal-making with cozy co-option. So instead of having strong regulations that would have put taxi industries on an equal footing, we have an unequal playing field where people who understood who to hire to go get the deal done behind closed doors did that and won.
What could they have done?
They could have just adopted San Francisco's taxi regulations and imposed those on Uber and Lyft. They could have required adequate commercial insurance or substantial commercial insurance. They could have required real background checks. But most importantly, they could have required worker protections. The PUC requires worker protections when it comes to other utilities. Why didn't they require worker protections when it came to these transportation companies? They're not a technology platform. They run a transportation company. If it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck, and this duck should be regulated.
What's the relationship like between Democrats in Sacramento and Uber and Lyft lobbyists?
You know, I don't know that. I do know that Uber and Lyft spend substantial amount of money lobbying in Sacramento. They also now spend substantial amounts of money lobbying the PUC.
So now that we all feel the effects of Uber and Lyft, the traffic, the potholes, right? Because the more cars on the road, the more potholes you're going to get. The greenhouse gas emissions. What could the PUC do tomorrow? Could it change and say, okay, you can only have a certain amount of drivers on the road. You've got to make sure Uber and Lyft, if you're offering cars to people, they have to be hybrids or electric. I mean, could they put those rules into effect? What would it take?
Absolutely. It would take 3 votes on the 5-person commission. And it would take a reopening of the decision that was made behind closed doors during the Mike Peavy era that basically just adopted the Lyft proposals, which were completely inadequate. But in addition, local governments can assess fees and some taxes, as San Francisco is considering doing. They can enforce their traffic laws, and potentially they could assess contributions for traffic and safety and environmental impacts. We haven't had any city go after these guys and take them to court and find out what the limits of city regulation are. We need a strong, proactive city to go say, enough is enough in my community. You need to play by the rules, and you need to be a good corporate citizen.
We have had Uber and Lyft drivers on. It's just saying that they have to work much longer hours now, and they just cannot make it. In May, Uber and Lyft drivers are basically demanded a $28 minimum hourly wage during rallies. What could the PUC do about wages and workers' rights, given that all of these drivers are contractors and they have no protections?
Well, I think the question of contractors is up in front of the legislature right now. And certainly the California Supreme Court has a different view of who is a contractor and who's an employee.
Right.
So the law, I think, is pretty expansive. The question is, will the PUC enforce the law? And will the PUC even consider the needs of the drivers, or will they continue to just consider the needs of the companies who hire friends and family of the commissioners and senior managers to come and talk to them?
As you said, there is a tax on Uber and Lyft that will be going to the voters. I want to just give people some information about this because we're going to be bombarded with a lot of propositions. This is from Curbed. City Hall just gave the final go-ahead for a ballot measure that would level a tax on Lyft and Uber rides and put the money toward transit programs, including a pledge to improve safety on San Francisco's most dangerous streets. This will be on our November ballot. Here's another story from Westside Today out of Los Angeles. The LA County Transportation Committee is also looking at regulations for Uber and Lyft. Okay, so the question is, Loretta, why is it taking so long? I mean, anyone who knows how these companies operate, you'd have to foresee the problems, even just the traffic alone, the greenhouse gas emissions. Why has it taken so long for local officials to tackle this issue?
you know, you'd have to ask the cities. But I will say this. I do think that the PUC went booga booga to the local officials and said, hey, that's our jurisdiction. And it was only when their inadequate regulations were proved to be sorely inadequate that the locals woke up and said, hey, the state's not going to do anything to protect our communities. We're going to have to figure out how to do it, even though the state's not helping us. They're actually hindering us. And you have to tip your hat to Uber and Lyft. They knew how to play the lobbying game. They played it expertly behind the scenes before anybody knew they were coming. They got their deal, and they ran with it.
And after they went public, they got incredibly wealthy. According to Business Insider, Garrett Camp, Uber's original founder, is now worth $3.5 billion. Travis Kalanick, the head of Uber, who was pushed out, $5 billion. I mean, we're talking about massive, massive amounts of money.
So it's really a mindset at the PUC. Are you for the people or are you for the companies? And the problem is, for the last 15 years, this PUC has said, we're going to trust the companies, and often we're not even going to verify. I would argue that you not only need to trust and verify. If you're going to trust, you have to verify whatever the companies are telling you. You actually shouldn't trust them. They have lost the benefit of the doubt in California. The people need to demand that their legislators and their governor make the PUC give the benefit of the doubt to the people and not the companies. Let's reverse that situation.
And what would you say is the most effective way to do that at this point? With so much money at stake.
So much money at stake, but there are 40 senators who need to vote on the PUC president's confirmation within the next 6 or 8 months. Go tell your senator, hey, do not vote for the president of the PUC unless that person can demonstrate by their votes that they are for the people, that they are for clean energy democracy, and they're not for Wall Street, and they're not for the utilities.
Well, we will definitely have you on again to continue this conversation. Loretta Lynch is former president of the California Public Utilities Commission. And I also just want to recognize that we do have listeners outside of the state, but these issues are happening in states across the country, right, Loretta? Especially when you're talking about regulating or not regulating companies like Uber and Lyft.
Absolutely. Both Uber and Lyft and utilities.
Right.
Every state has a public utilities commission. Sadly, for California, ours is a lapdog.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about why so many horses are dying. 30 horses have died at the Santa Anita Racetrack in Southern California since last December. Horse racing is a multi-billion dollar industry. Can it be reformed or should it be banned? That is tomorrow. Thanks to Shireen Adel for producing today's show, and Kevin Vance and Damian Miner, our studio engineers. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.